Thank you.
Thank you very much, and many thanks to Borbála for the really the revelation of her poetry. I'm going to read. We'll start with a poem called The Witch in the Wardrobe. And so she opened the plank door where the dry palm branches had always perched, balancing lightly, pegged over the architrave. She swam at once inside a fluent pantry, a grange of luxury. The silk scarves came flying at her face like a car wash, then brushed her cheeks and shoulders coolly down. The fur slid over her skin, oiled and ready, and a cashmere sleeve whispered, probing her ear, "We were here all along, like an engine idling, warm, gentle and alert. What will you do now?" But when she closed her eyes to feel it closer, their swatch of sublime purples, intensely swooping and spinning, dived past her, cooing like pigeons, their prickling mauve inside her stretched eyelids. The bridge was gone, and beyond it, she could no longer see her body, its flesh without stain, its innocent skin. I'm going to read a couple of poems which are about Cork. Recently, I've been writing about the life of Nan O'Nagle and her foundation in the South Parish, about the idea about convents and convent life generally, and particularly about that part of the city, which is also celebrated by a number of people no longer with us, particularly Patrick Galvin, Liam O'Murrihe, who died last year, this year actually, Bob Welsh, Robert Welsh, poet and novelist, who died a few years ago. Obviously a very fertile part of the city, and I started thinking about this strange woman who didn't exactly want to be a nun, and who particularly didn't want to be to live in a cloister, and she's on record as saying, "Perfect enclosure is not possible in Ireland." So this is called An Imperfect Enclosure, and it's all true. She was out in all weathers. She was tired. Someone gave her a chair in a shop, rested, and then away, in the street, on the move. The house she built first, giving on the street, could she close up doors and windows on that side? It would be noticed as a convent. She asked to be buried in the common cemetery. They broke through the wall of the nun's graveyard and slipped her coffin inside. But she would not stay, so they built her a stone tomb nearer to Cove Lane and opened a latch at one end so hands can touch the coffin. They've actually moved her again since I wrote that poem, this time because of disabled access. So she's clearly an extremely unstable saint. I'm going to read a poem which is also about convents, but this time an imaginary one. It's called Carr's Lane. It's about the idea, it's about some of these places that you see in Cork. There's an old house, there's obviously a story behind it, but you don't know what it is. And in my idea of this is that it's the last years of a decayed convent. Carr's Lane. You can see the tall front door, but don't expect to be admitted. On your left is Carr's Lane, at the corner a newspaper shop. Up the lane a door, stone steps worn pale by rain and people climbing, unlocks at the agreed time on quiet days for callers they know. Scholars disagree about Carr's Lane. Is it Cart's Lane corrupted, or was there a prosperous local merchant family called Carr? They could have grown rich selling butter to the transatlantic trade or beef abroad. If their books gave their story, those have all been closed. The dealer came one Monday, early. The shelves were bare before noon. The library is closed off, dangerous. Woodworm in the floorboards. I'm going to read a poem called The Distance for my friend Mairéilín Mhurchú, the wife and then the widow of the sculptor Seamus Murphy. And it's about the way she died at the age of 94, and she was one of the people that I've known longest in my life. I'm going to read this for her daughter, Orla, who's here. But one of the things about her was the way she somehow kept her distance from the bourgeois life of Cork, and how this was partly connected with her own work as an artist, which involved, in fact, I remember her showing it to me when I was trying to learn to draw myself, the way you have to pick an angle and see things from a certain distance. Even with her beside him, The distance. Even with her beside him in the boat, he never liked the water. He fingered a stone in his pocket. But she looked back at the town of Yall, where she grew up. She saw the pleated wake and the long lines delighted her, their fading distance. Where a line of waves hemmed an edging of sand, a line of houses crouching, and between the boat and the land swam a vacant pool of light. And beyond that, absence lay, a world that was sold for huddling doubts and envies. She would see across the pub lounge where the ladies ordered brandies, the discretion of light, the indigo tones of their new suits for Easter, warm as a plum. She would feel the gap she could not cross again. When she drew a line on the floor with chalk and I stood behind it, I could see how firmly shapes were herded, how they clung, the stones of the graveyard nudging the steeple, the roof of a shop pressed down by the barracks wall, and where the stone steps crossed the railway line, a dark tunnelled space opening like memory. Across that pause, remember her, the crime novels, the cigarettes, the bottle of stout, her back kitchen kept cold by the damp cliff behind it, so the milk stayed fresh. The old tree whispers its news to the trailing bramble. The roots of the white thorn finger the founding stones under the ring fort, whose shape can best be seen in the distance, dark against the sky. I'm going to read two poems which I wrote so as not to be doing something else. I was asked to make a speech at the launch of a book by a great friend of mine, Lucy McDiarmid. The book is called The Peacock Dinner. But it describes a famous dinner attended by W.B. Yeats and other poets, but also an earlier dinner at which there were cats. But which the cats were removed. So I thought I won't make a speech because I'm not terribly good at that. I write a poem instead. The cat dinner. We knew they were there, their flattened black masks, and that when they withdrew into lunar shadow, there would be no witness, a cobwebby silence. Lips open, but speech fails round the half-cleared table, sitting there but strangers, our fussy notes shuffled, lying at random. We made the long journey to deliver the gesture, but who noticed us? Like the food left outside for visiting spirits, which is gone the next morning. But did the cats eat it? A more successful, possibly, poem written to avoid doing something else. When my son Neil got married, it was a civil wedding and we weren't We hadn't been to very many of those, and we were told you can have one parent on each side may speak for 2 minutes and don't mention religion. So I started to write a speech, and at a certain point I thought, firstly, if I mention the Book of Ruth, it'll be too late for them to stop me. And anyway, they won't know it's in the Bible unless I tell them. So I thought of that. So I thought I'd write a poem instead of writing a speech. Because it was an Irish man and a Russian woman, I thought I'd include some themes out of both Irish and Russian folklore. So this is to Neil Woods and Zenia Ostrovskaya, married in Dublin on the 9th of September 2009. When you look out across the fields and you both see the same star pitching its tent on the point of the steeple, that is the time to set out on your journey with half a loaf and your mother's blessing. Leave behind the places that you knew. All that you leave behind, you will find once more. You will find it in the stories. The Sleeping Beauty in her high tower, with her talking cat asleep, solid beside her feet. You will see her again. When the cat wakes up, he will speak in Irish and Russian, and every night he will tell you a different tale about the fire bird that stole the golden apples, gone every morning out of the emperor's garden, and about the King of Ireland's son and the enchanter's daughter. The story the cat does not know is the Book of Ruth, and I have no time to tell you how she fared when she went out at night and she was afraid in the beginning of the barley harvest, or how she trusted to strangers and stood by her word. You will have to trust me. She lived happily ever after. This one is called The Sister, and as I mentioned, I'm very interested in the history of nuns, and I've written many poems about them. And in this one, though, I did what I really had been trying to do for years. I got a nun onto a train, because I have also got an obsession with trains. My grandfather was a station master, and my aunts were nuns. So in this case, I seem to have managed it. It's called The Sister. How on earth did she manage that journey on her own? When she was a young woman, they had plenty to keep them busy. They were small, they felt queasy. They gripped a pillar in the shade and held on. And as for leaving home, still the trains have never changed. They thunder up the valleys, built for strapping fellows, flinging their big bundles easily onto high shelves, real men. She turned up at the station, small, her clothes once elegant, all black. Past the train window slid the suburbs, a fast river. She saw a white-haired man, waist-deep, ducking under and rising again, a cormorant. A lump of a lad handed her bag down to her. Lopsided, she walked as far as the convent door. They greeted her with a leathery kiss. They told her where to find her bed and the hour of dinner. They knew the silent meal would be no surprise, no more than the hard bread, tougher at every slice, nor the dead silence of night until the first train troubled the valley. She would know, lying there, others were sitting up, working in pairs, to finish the stitching, tacking the last of the lace. But the cold woke her, and a subtle mist as fine as gauze hung on the glass. In the freezing dawn, she dragged a web just as light across her skin, veiling herself for good, and she slept on. I'm going to read a poem, I find it, called Monsters. And It's not about nuns. but it ends up with a reference to a moment in Ovid's poem, The Metamorphoses, where the god Dionysus is found a drunk youngster by a bunch of sailors who think, aha, we'll sell him as a slave. And they have him, they offer him a lift on their ship, and when they have him out at sea, they try to tie him up, and then he suddenly turns the tables on them and turns them, in fact he turns them into dolphins. Now that there's nothing I don't understand, why do they come to me with their informations? They come in my dreams with their highlighting pens. They tell me the Roman numerals on the shelf end panels in the cathedral library have all been regilded. Someone has worked with agate and crow's feathers to raise gold flourishes and leaf script capitals. Show us, they ask, the book that opens like a curtain. And I tell them about the day I met Ovid in the street and he passed me without a greeting. He had just thought of the words that made the shrouds and tackling swell with small buds, then looping stems, then five-pointed leaves of ivy catching, clutching the oars. When I read it again myself, I can see the oarsmen frozen at their work. The sleepy, drunk youngster they were planning to sell, that wept when they tied his hands, all of a sudden in charge, his forehead ornate with grapes. He is balanced on delicate sandals, watching how they change. Their spines curve, they dance in the waves. Each man a monster to his neighbour. I read two more poems. This one, they're both connected with the great Irish writer Maria Edgeworth, who in a late novel, she was trying to finish this novel before her father died, so that he could see the proofs, and he actually wrote some of it as he went along, and one of the things he wrote is a description of a jailbreak in which an innocent man finds himself in jail, and he finds that he's sharing a cell with a man who's a famous jailbreaker, who has been promised a pardon if he'll get out of this jail and then tell the judge how he did it. So the poem is called Kilmainham. Tell me, he said, how you managed to break out of my jail so that I can build a better one that will not fail. So I explained about the whistle and the gin, the special shoes and so forth, and I threw in the ropes made out of blankets, the false handcuffs, the vitriol, the cunning tailored loose-cut trousers, the tobacco pipe, and all to distract him from the innocent who passed down the high wall at my side, who is wandering the world now, transparent as the ocean, as the glassy flow of shallow tides over stones. Will he ever get home at all? I've been reading and admiring the work of Maria Edgeworth all my working life, well, long before my working life, actually. In 1847, she was aged 79, and she was working to raise money for famine relief. She was writing stories, which she sold to raise money, and she was also writing to her contacts, especially in America, to ask for help. And she heard the memoir that was written by her stepmother, who was actually younger than her, says, she was touched by the generosity of the porters who carried the rice and India meal to the vessels for shipment to Ireland in the famine, refusing all payment. And she knit with her own hands a woolen comforter for each porter of bright and pretty colours, which she sent to a friend to present to the men, who were proud and grateful for the gifts. But alas, before they received them, those kind hands were cold, and that warm heart had ceased to beat. The other thing to be said about this poem is I imagined, of course, that the porters who refused payment for carrying the food probably included a number of Irish immigrants. And there's an early story by Mariah Edgeworth about a little boy who manages to support his family by, when the coaches are passing the door on a hill and the horses are too tired to go any further, he runs out and puts a stone behind the wheel of the coach so that the horses can rest. And then he hopes that the people in the coach will throw him farthings. So I imagine if that child grew up and was a dock worker in America. So Mariah Edgeworth in 1847. Anger, work, confusion, what is to be done? The Atlantic in the way and the news getting worse. Work stretching to occupy every hour in the day, carrying back and forth, lifting, bearing, and setting down. We are in the centuries where work told the body how to lift, fasten, and drag. The weight of the world needed heaving. When the horses staggered and slowed on the steep hill, the coach too full, too heavy to drag onwards, they stopped fearfully, and the child from the cabin was waiting for his chance. He ran out with a stone, pushed it behind the wheel so the horses could breathe, and waited for the farthings flung from the passengers' windows. Now he is carrying sacks of meal to the boat, back and forth, loaded then free, and the work stretching ahead, like the road where at the same moment Mariah Edgeworth walks out, her young servant beside her carrying the basket that gets a bit lighter at every cabin door. This is her work now, at the end of her life. At home, she sits down to the story she is writing, line after line, her hand straying back and forth across her remaining pages. The child from the cabin is a man carrying meal to the docks, and at last the day is over and time for him to be paid. But he is too angry, his colleagues are too angry, to take money for helping to feed starving people. And she, who is not ever recorded as being angry, takes out her knitting needles and the long skeins of wool the women have spun in the cabins to make a warm comforter for every man, her needles twitching back and forth until the work is done. She is famous and fortunate. She will be remembered. Like the girl whose brothers were turned into swans, she does what she knows, the long scarves piling softly beside her chair, one after the other, like the days. They are far from home when her gift reaches them, the trace of their work unraveling like a worn thread of wool.